Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Soldiers of Cinema podcast. With me, as always, back from his long journey through, was it just America? Did you do
just
like
America,
a long,
yeah.
just America, road trip, a month-long road trip. Maybe we'll hear some about that. But with me, as always, is Mr. Cullen McFader, and I am Clark Coffey, and we are so thrilled to be back with you after a bit of a break. Today, we're going to be discussing Cullen's pick, which just so happens to be, assuming that you've not read the title, 1972, Alfred Hitchcock, Frenzy.
I dare say you are wondering why I am floating around London like this. I am on the famous Thames River, investigating a murder. Rivers can be very sinister places, and in my new film, Frenzy, this river, you may say, was the scene of a very horrible murder.
It's a woman!
Another necktie murder.
Of course, one can never be sure where danger lurks. They tell me a dreadful crime was committed right in this building. My investigation next led me to this innocent alley, of which there are hundreds in London. But I don't think we should stay long. Something unpleasant is about to happen. Of another horrible murder. This is the famous London wholesale fruit and vegetable market, Covent Garden. Here you may buy the fruits of evil and the horrors of vegetables. I've heard of a leg of lamb, a leg of chicken, but never a leg of potatoes. How do you like my tie? How do you like it?
My God, the tie.
What an interesting selection. This came out of nowhere. I totally wasn't expecting this one, man. And I haven't seen this movie in forever. So I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting. I can't remember too much of this film. Unique pick. I'm excited to discuss it. I was totally caught off guard by this one. That's a good selection, dude.
Well, I thought, I think it's no secret that I'm a big Hitchcock fan. I mean, I think we did an episode on kind of what got us into movies. And one of the things that I said was that, you know, growing up, my dad used to always show me Hitchcock movies and things like that. And, so I always sort of saw them as almost contemporary movies. I think I was too young to kind of figure out that they weren't made today.
Yeah.
So I think I just thought that he was a very interesting stylistic kind of director.
Yeah, that's like me with the 50s War of the Worlds. I'm watching that when I'm like six, and I'm like, I have no idea that this wasn't made like last year, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it kind of removes some of that preconceived notion that people get when they go into an old movie and think that it's going to be, you know, boring or flat or something. But
sure.
And I was surprised that we hadn't done a Hitchcock movie yet, because I mean, we're 80 something episodes into the podcast.
So why do you think we've been dancing around that one? My take is, at least for me, I guess it's always like, I mean, and that's one of the things I think is such an interesting pick here is that, you know, Hitchcock seems like such an obvious choice. Now, obviously, we've picked films that were obvious choices. And so, you know, but yeah, I'm kind of surprised that we're, you know, how many years, how many number of episodes into this. And this is the first Hitchcock film we've done. That's I was shocked when you told me that. I was like, wait a minute. Surely we've done a Hitchcock film before.
Yeah,
we haven't.
I mean, I'm sure we've talked about them plenty Frenzy. Because I think the even when we did the episode on Daylight Again, the movie that I did, you know, I talked about how much influence Hitchcock had on that. So I think he's come up in so many conversations. Maybe it just kind of, to me, it just almost slipped my mind that we haven't done him. And I think it's also one of those things where you don't want to do, I mean, Psycho or Vertigo, Rear Window have all been talked to death, you know, like it's like, well, what could we possibly add to that conversation?
Whereas... I almost did Rope. I came really close Rope's a great picking one, Rope.
And I think the reason I chose Frenzy was just, because I'm thinking, you know, it's a movie that not a lot of people outside of, you know, Hitchcock fans have seen, despite the fact that I think it's a quite a good movie. And I think that it's interesting because it's his, one of his last movies as well. Right before Family Plot, and I think this is a superior movie, so I kind of in my own personal canon consider this kind of his swan song. But you also get this very interesting, we're going to talk about this obviously in detail, but this really interesting blend of kind of Hitchcock's, you know, of course a director most famous for his work in the 50s and 60s and the 40s and before that. So you have a director known for a lot of like very formalistic choices and very you know, brightly lit studio kind of filmmaking. And not that, you know, that doesn't make him boring to me. I love most of his movies. But you end up getting kind of this blend in this movie of this kind of almost like 70s exploitation, kind of like sex crime thriller things that really seem like something that Hitchcock always would have been heading towards, kind of his natural progression as a filmmaker, because, I mean, he was always kind of pushing those boundaries. You know, especially in something like Psycho, where he was breaking a lot of the Hays Code rules to kind of push the audience further into a level of discomfort. This is kind of the only one of his movies where he really does sort of land directly in that genre and kind of, if anything, I think has likely, with this movie specifically, cast a massive influence on a lot of later films. But we'll get into that later because we've got so much to talk about there.
I want to ask you a quick question since you are such a fan. I mean, not to put you on the spot, but you know, I'm curious. There are some who think that you know, what makes me think of this is Tarantino. You know, he's kind of notoriously, or he's been known, you know, like, hey, I'm only making 10 films, and I'm like arbitrarily cutting myself off after my 10th film because, you know, almost universally across the board, directors make films when they're past their, you know, expiration date, and they're the last films of their filmography end up sucking and they taint their, you know, their legacy, so to speak. What are your thoughts on that regarding Hitchcock? You know, it's, gosh, I mean, he made so many films and, you know, this, like we've said, is his second to last film. And I think you and many other people consider this to be, you know, if not, I don't know if you'd go so far as to say masterpiece, but consider it a pretty darn good film. But then, of course, he had Torn Curtain and Topaz before that, which most people agree are not fantastic films. But what are your thoughts? Does Hitchcock fall into that category of should have quit earlier? Maybe like, you know, The Birds should have been his last film? Or do you think, no, he held up relatively strong to the end? Like, what are your thoughts?
I think he held up pretty, like, I mean, I think I the way I look at it is, and this will be a good throwback for the podcast, I remember when the original trailer for the Werner Herzog masterclass, somebody said there was like a quote about like, even his failures are spectacular. That was one of the like splash quotes on the screen at the end of it, just kind of talking about Herzog. And I kind of think about that in the same way as Hitchcock, where it's like, not that I think that, you know, I'm not a big fan of Topaz, and I don't really like Family Plot either. And Torn Curtain, I'm okay with. I enjoy a lot of aspects of Torn Curtain, but I think that even in that, it's sort of like, well, I don't like them necessarily as Hitchcock movies. I don't think that they're his best. But at the same time, there's so much that you get out of watching them still because of the choices that he's making. And it's kind of one of those things where you like, I always think back you know, I watch his movies pretty regularly, so it's never like I'm forgetting what he's like as a filmmaker. But quite frequently, I'm sort of like, you know, maybe he's kind of just this immortalized director who has this, you know, the legend of him is much bigger than his movies mm-hmm. could ever be. And then you go back and you watch his movies and you're like, no, you know, he was kind of a genius of the form.
It.
Like he was yep. really a master of, I mean, you see even some of the shots in this movie that are just so like I was watching it last night with a grin on my face when some of these moments happen, because I'm just like, God, like, how could you even think about that as a director? Like, how do you think of those choices that he makes, like the famous pullout from the building that we'll get into all that stuff mm-hmm. in detail. But I think, yeah, I think that, you know, the fact that he made this as his second last movie, I think that if you look at the chronology of his filmmaking, I mean, it wasn't that long after Birds that he, you know, that he's only got two movies or three movies between this and the Birds, right? So
there certainly are a few duds.
Yeah, Birds and then Marnie. And I do
Torn
like Marnie
Curtain
a lot.
In 66. Yep, Torn Curtain in 66, Topaz in 69, mm-hmm. Frenzy in 72, and then you have 76 Family Plot.
Yeah, so, yeah. So he was definitely slowing down, obviously, in his age, too, so there's a longer period between his movies. But I think if you actually look at the chronology, no, I think that he, you know, maybe I could have done without Family Plot, but I still enjoy watching Family Plot. Like, I don't love it, but I think that there's definitely value to that movie. So yeah, I think that he, you know, I don't think that he kind of wore himself out or anything. I think that he's doing stuff in Frenzy that is really, really interesting, really, you know, some very new things for him that are completely, I mean, it's his first movie to show like explicit nudity. The violence is a lot more visceral in this movie.
New to
yet
him,
it still
but,
has...
let, but let's be clear though, not new to cinema, but
no,
certainly
no, of course.
New,
yeah, his,
new to
his first
his
film.
Bag of tricks. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not just speaking about the nudity, of course, but I mean other things that we'll get into. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That we'll get into for sure, just to clarify.
But yeah, definitely like, you know, a more explicitly violent movie than anything else he's done. Mm-hmm. And it really gets into a lot of, I think, interesting places that kind of are a very interesting kind of alternate history thing to think about like what would Hitchcock have been making through the 70s and 80s if he had lived longer and things like that. And
but I think that's all interesting. Yeah. I think that's all interesting. But just to play counterpoint, and then we're going to go on to a quick summary of the film, and we're going to dive in. But just to play counterpoint, maybe if he had stopped at the Birds, though, I mean, I don't know. Just as a thought experiment, if that had been his last film, right? And so he goes out on Vertigo, North by Northwest, Psycho. I mean, maybe if he'd even stopped at Psycho, right? Because the mm-hmm. Birds is kind of, I don't know, does that hold up, you know, as well as those other films, you know, in today's day and age? I don't know. It's, you know, especially, I mean, and maybe it's just me. I feel like I've been ruined by that movie Birdemic. Now, I haven't watched, heard about this? Now, look, I haven't seen the whole film. It's not like I've sat down and watched the whole film, but I have seen like clips of the film Birdemic, right?
Yes.
That just ruined me about the like idea of, you know, any movie about like birds attacking people.
Yes.
Just turned it into like a giant gimmick, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, interestingly though, I think The Birds has a lot of like kind of these sexual promiscuity kind of undertones about like, you know, the pun, like almost an earlier version of
which would go on to be a horror film genre, you know, main.
So it's certainly
thread,
I enjoy The Birds. I have a very fond A lot of fond yeah, memories yeah. Of watching that.
But I'm just, but like I said, a thought experiment, you know,
had
he gone out on that string of mm-hmm. literally masterpieces, right? One after the other. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But hey, I tend to agree with you though. You know, look, you're an artist, you're making films. It's to me, it seems a little bit ridiculous to arbitrarily cut yourself off. If you're still enjoying making movies, to arbitrarily cut yourself off from doing so because you're afraid that you might hurt your legacy, I don't know.
And I think that also, I mean, I think that to me, there's an inherent value in just the creation of art, good or bad. I mean, obviously I kind of draw a line at like corporate art, like
you mean
a lot
advertising
that are out today, but
Oh, I see. What like Marvel.
Yeah, like just like, you know, Marvel. Big, you yeah. know, movies that are made by focus groups and, you know, board of directors as opposed to.
To sell being, toys. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that, so I think that I've always, you know, not to get too far into the Tarantino conversation, but in relation to this, I've always kind of thought that, yeah, it's a little bit arbitrary and it's like, well, why not just keep, who cares if you have.
If you enjoy it.
You know.
If you're enjoying it, keep going. I agree with you. Well, hey, why don't you take it away with a brief summary of Frenzy and then we're going to dive in.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, this is a very classically Hitchcock plot. There's a reason that people kind of described it as his return to kind of like the murder thriller suspense genre after doing kind of political movies for the last two, I think he'd done were kind of more about like political thrillers and intrigue. But yeah, basically it's about this guy named Richard who's let off from his job. He's a bartender and he is, his boss is a little bit, you know, kind of hard on him because he drinks, but he says that he always pays, gets laid off.
I love this boss, by the way.
Yeah, right? God, he's funny. Like, yeah.
He doesn't care as much that the guy's drinking on the job. Now again, we're in England, this is in the early 70s, so you know, it's a different time. But he like accuses him of stealing the drinks. I just love it though. It's
He's like, you're not paying. Yeah, it's not about drinking on the job, it's just the fact that he's not paying for them. But he says he is. But anyway, so you kind of get this very interesting introduction to our character where it's like he seems honest, but you also don't quite know. Hitchcock also plays with this idea of kind of setting the audience up to believe that he might be this necktie murderer.
Well, because
of course,
open with the movie. Right. We've got this beautiful shot, this helicopter shot that just... we're going down the Thames, right? And what's the bridge? What's the drawbridge there that we're flying?
The one in Tower Bridge, yeah.
Yeah. Tower Bridge, just a beautiful, so beautifully executed. Like really surprisingly smooth. Anyway, not to get derailed onto the technicals of that, but yeah, and we've got this politician, right? And there's this group of people and the politician is like, we're going to clean up the river. We're going to da-da-da-da-da. And then, of course, in like beautiful Hitchcock, you know, humor, ironic humor, there floats the naked body of the victim with the necktie around their neck. And so then,
the latest necktie victim, yeah. And so he does something really right brilliant, which is that they mention the tie and then it cuts immediately to our character, Richard, putting on his tie. And so it's kind of this like subtle implication of these red herrings of, is he really the killer? He gets laid off. He, you know, has a friend, Bob Rusk, who is kind of offering to help him out and gives
let's not forget Richard's friend at the bar.
Oh, yes, Richard's friend, Babs.
Who defends his honor. Babs is the barmaid there. She defends his honor.
And they're kind of having a little bit of a relationship.
Yes, I would say they are.
So we're introducing these cast of characters. There's Bob Rusk, his friend. Babs is his barmaid friend who's kind of seeing his ex-wife.
Now I'm curious though. Let me stop you there for a second. When we're introduced to Bob, right? Is it Bob?
Bob Rusk.
And yeah. Bob Rusk. Now Bob Rusk is going to end up. Now look, this is obviously this recap is like we're not trying to explain every aspect of the film. It's like if you've seen it, but it's been a long time. We're hoping this kind of jogs your memory. If you've not seen it and you just don't want to see it, we're trying to give you enough information that you could kind of follow along with the rest of our conversation. Although you should definitely go see it. But but Bob Rusk, played by Barry Foster. I'm curious what your thoughts were. So yeah, so you know, our hero, or maybe not our hero or the killer, we don't know yet. But he's introduced, his lady's introduced. He gets fired. He goes across the street to hang out with his buddy Bob. And were you almost thrown off by how generous Bob was, right? Like, I mean, right off the bat, right? He's like, hey, let me give you some money. Let me give you some food. Let me da da da.
Yeah, here's a tip on a horse that is going to win.
Yeah, and here's a tip on a horse. And if you need anything, I can do it all. Like, what do you need? Here, let me give you my jacket. Here, do you need some fresh undies? I'll take mine off and give them. Like, it's like, was it just me? Am I just too sadly cynical and skeptical in this modern era? Where I just would never, ever assume that somebody would be that overwhelmingly nice and generous. But to me, like right off the bat, I'm like, oh, hell, this is not good. Was it just me? Did you have that
feeling?
No,
I totally, I could totally understand. And I think that Hitchcock is trying to not, you know, he's not necessarily being too subtle with that too, where it's like you then later find out because, you know, our Richard's ex-wife is a, she's kind of like a matchmaker in a way, and that's her business. So she.
That's right. So our man Richard gets fired. He go get some grapes and a tip on a horse from his buddy Bob working at the vegetable distribution warehouse.
Yeah, he's like a fruit or vegetable distributor.
I'm in the import export business, baby. Potatoes, carrots.
Art Vandelay.
Yeah. I forgot that. That'll always make me laugh. That will always make me laugh, man. And anyway, yes, Art Vandelay.
Importer exporter.
Importer exporter. So okay. Before I get way off track here, I am in a distractible mood this morning. And so he's gonna pay a visit to his ex-wife, and you're right. His ex-wife runs this matchmaker business, which I didn't even know they had back then, but clearly they did. I think of this as like a modern thing with apps and stuff, but this actually existed back then. So she runs a matchmaking business. He goes in and, you know, they kind of have a little bit of not a fight, argument, kind of, you know,
they raise their voices. Yeah.
You can tell their 10 years of marriage must have been a wonderful harmony. being sarcastic, but anyway. But they kind of have a bit of an argument there, and then you're supposed to take over there.
The key is that her secretary. Yes, of course. Yeah, tossing it back to me. The key, of course, is that her secretary hears them arguing, then unbeknownst to the secretary, the next day, Bob Rusk, our main character Richard's friend, who offered him all this great stuff, comes in and is basically turned away by Brenda, the matchmaker and our main character's ex-wife, because
we don't have women like that.
He had sexually, you had sexual proclivities that were gauche, I suppose. And so,
what do they say? Yeah, it's like
it's kind of funny, the language they use.
It's like we don't have clientele with proclivities in that. I don't know. It's very
department.
British. I can't.
Yeah.
proclivities in that department. Yeah.
And so it's not specific.
It's not specific, but we do get the idea. Our imaginations are let to run wild as to what those proclivities may be.
Mm-hmm. And another key here is that the secretary is out at this moment. She's not in. So we then see the first murder of the film on camera, and we get
Bob Rusk super uncomfortable.
Yeah, very, very. It's actually quite, again, very
it is
visceral.
Not, this is not a pleasant viewing experience at all.
Yeah,
this is,
and it's,
I
and
was
it's
actually
very
pretty
violent. There's nudity. Yep. There's
it's not violent in the sense of what we would consider like modern violence, right? Where there's like, you know, the thrashing and gnashing and throwing around and hitting
gore
and
or whatever. Yeah,
and there's no gore, but it is just almost. Because it's like in the opposite of this. It's like it was like very unsettling. I mean, very effective because it's supposed to be. And in watching it, I mean, we're still in the summary here, so I don't want to get too far off. But while we're talking about it, I mean, it was in this scene where I had this very kind of like, immediate kind of reaction of like, oh my gosh, this feels like a precursor to what horror would become pretty soon with Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Friday the 13th and Halloween. I felt like we were looking at kind of like some of the genesis of that, or maybe it was that he was incorporating, you know, some of where like exploitation films were starting to go in the 70s, in the early 70s, and he was kind of incorporating some of that. But I was, and it's not that he hasn't done some things like this before. I mean, I think about Psycho and the way that's shot and cut. You can certainly see like a thread here of his technique, you know, shifting. It's not like came out of nowhere, but that's kind of where my mind kind of went. I was like, whoa, this seems to kind of point to some of that.
Yeah, it's definitely pushing the line further than he ever has. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another key, other than the secretary being absent here too, is that Bob Rusk says right before he murders Brenda that she's his type. That, you know, he has this line saying, "You know, you're my type." Now here is where the very Hitchcock kind of, you know, I don't know what I would call it, but wrongfully accusation sort of. That sort of thing begins, which is that Bob murders Brenda.
It's like the every man being accused of a crime or being put in some kind of like, they think he's a spy. They think he's a murderer. Yeah. And I'm just the every man regular dude. Why? What's going on? Yeah. Kind of that.
And so so Bob leaves the, but has a key. I can't remember exactly where he says that. I think he says he swiped the key or something and has a key to the office, locks the office and leaves. Right as
you were probably checking Instagram at that moment.
Right as Richard Blaney enters the. Oh yes, of course, because he entered. Yeah, Richard Blaney enters. The door is locked. He doesn't see Bob Rusk leave, and then so he turns around and leaves as well. Our secretary is just returning from her lunch break and
comes
sees
right back.
Richard leaving and assumes that he was the one that was just in the building, despite the fact that he couldn't get in, and we know that he was not the murderer. So she goes up, finds the body, and then.
Well, now, but in a Hitchcockian, this is one of his great. This was kind of brilliance, right? This is Hitchcock's brilliance. Yeah, yeah. Instead of us like going up inside the building and being with the secretary and watch her open the door and sit down her purse and kind of do this and that, and then you know call out to you know her coworker. Oh, there's no response. Oh, I should go check. Oh, mm-hmm. I opened the door and oh no, murdered person. Instead of any of that, right? We're outside. We stay on the same shot. We watch Richard leave.
Yeah, we watch her.
We have the same wide. We have the exterior of the building. We watch the secretary go in. It's just, and we're anticipating.
Yeah, we just sit outside and watch the
door. We know what she's going to see. We know what she's going to see. And then, of course, it's the scream. And another brilliant touch, right? It's not just that there's the scream. We have two other women now, pedestrians, walking, just walking into the scene. They're just going about their business. And, of course, we have them. Hitchcock has them there to react to the scream along with us.
Yeah. So you don't see anything inside the building after that. And it's great. He does that kind of a few times in this movie where he'll play with sound and kind of just use the sound design as a way to,
I'm curious. Let's pause here for a minute. You know, what are your thoughts? I mean, are there films today that would handle this in this way?
I think there are few directors that would, but I can think of a few that kind of have, you know, interesting choice making like this, but definitely few and far between in terms of the kind of the subtlety and the restraint that Hitchcock shows. I think that that's one of the things that I find so interesting about Hitchcock is that he so often shows a lot of restraint in these ways and to a very effective end, and in my opinion,
I think
it's
a confidence in the audience. I think it's a confidence in the audience is what is my kind of interpretation. It's like, I think it is it's a reliance on the audience's imagination and a confidence in their imagination that you don't have to show now. But of course, in the scene that we just saw before that with the actual murder, I mean, he didn't leave anything to the imagination there. It was extremely graphic and extremely, I mean, he put it all out there. So obviously, you know, what I kind of see is this interesting dynamic is that you have this, like, we go from one extreme to the other. Mm-hmm. So there's this like great dynamic range. So he's not choosing to shoot every single scene this way. Mm-hmm. But there's a really interesting dynamic range, you know, almost if you kind of make an analogy to music, right? There's like these very, very like soft lows and then these very dramatic high highs. But there's this huge dramatic range or dynamic range rather and dramatic range that's what I think is so interesting here. That's what I feel like sometimes I feel lacking in a lot of films and it was probably lacking in films in that era too. So I'm not trying to make that age old, like, oh, you know, today's movies, they just stink. But I just think across the board, we don't see very often, or maybe it's not as much as I would like to see that dynamic range, you know, in ways to approach scenes. Anywho.
Well, I also think it engages you in a way that seeing her go, like I can imagine Hitchcock saying, you know, why do we need to see her go up and enter and find the body when we know what she's going to find? And rather, you kind of engage the audience, like you said, this
absolutely
imaginative sense of, well, why not put a little flair on this and have it be something that the audience sort of is like the suspense of it also. I mean, you know that she's going to go in there. You know that she's going to.
There's the key.
You know that you're going to find a scream.
You're waiting for it.
Or hear a scream.
You're waiting for it.
And so, yeah, exactly. You're waiting for it. And you're just waiting for it to scream. And I almost, like, even when I was watching it last night, I remember thinking to myself, I was like, okay, she's going up the stairs. She's unlocking the door.
You see every room.
And it's like you don't see any of that, though. You're just looking at the entrance of the on the street. And so then when we finally get to that scream, you're expecting it, but it's like, you know, it's like letting off a firework or something where it's like, you know, that the bang is coming.
Yeah. You're watching the fuse. You're watching the fuse.
Exactly.
Yeah. You nailed it. Anyway, it's something that stands out to me consistently with Hitchcock's work. Of course, I'm not, there's nothing, you know, revelatory there, of course, but, okay.
Yeah.
Yes. So
I mean, to briefly summarize too, and just kind of like, we don't have to go through obviously the details of everything, but essentially the movie becomes about Richard Blaney trying to evade police because the secretary, of course, is, you know, understandably says he was here yesterday, he was yelling, and they got into a row, and now, you know, he's obviously the murderer, and so. We've got this very interesting thing where Richard Blaney has to kind of profess his innocence to everyone that he sees and, you know, needs to get help from people. And Babs specifically, she believes that he's innocent as well because there's, you know, she says there's no way that he could have been there. And then we find out, of course, we've already known this, but Bob Rusk is, of course, kind of egging him on and playing him as a fool because we don't know, or the character doesn't know, that Bob Rusk is, of course, the killer. So you just have this very interesting kind of dynamic of you know, this innocent man who's charged with something, but that also allows the killer to kind of take a little bit more of a, you know, have a little bit more freedom with what he's doing because he's like, oh, they're off looking for this other guy. And
let's just pause for a minute in this, you know, it's interesting to me that Richard, the innocent character, I mean, he's not portrayed as a great guy at all.
No,
He's... I mean, really, he's kind of about like a rastabout, like just, I mean, he's like not got a job, or he barely had a job whenever we see him. Now he's fired. He doesn't have any money. He's like, you know, he's you know, pitches a fit with
kind
his ex-wife
at
her place of business, totally disrespecting her and her work and her business. You know, then somehow, I don't know how or why, she's kind enough to invite him to dinner. And he's an ass there at dinner, and he's literally like breaking glassware. I mean, it's like he's just not really a great dude, really. But he's also not a horrible dude. He's just a dude. But it's just interesting. I just wanted to pause for a minute because I think a lot of times in movies, right, where you have this character set up, right, the whole premise is like, oh, you know, it's like unjustly, you know, this character is going to be unjustly seen as guilty, and da 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 da. That we often like kind of have this character. You know, okay, well, we really have to like this character. Like, really has to be a likable person, you know? But it's not the case here. Not the case here at all. Sorry, I just wanted to interject.
No, I mean, I think that is a really good point that he's not, he's not a particularly, I mean, he's not an unlikable character, but he's a very much an everyman. You know, he's flawed and he's got, he's not very polite. Again, as you said, he's kind of belligerent and he drinks a lot. And so he's definitely not someone that you're kind of almost constantly saying like, okay, well, maybe just be a little bit kinder to people and maybe they'd help you out.
So
the movie goes on with that. And then eventually he is actually found and arrested, and Babs is also killed. That's a great scene too.
Well,
we should talk about
that. And how he's arrested, of course, is pretty interesting, right?
Now
we kind of revisit this, right? So because he goes to Bob for help. Bob's like, hey, you could stay at my place, you know? And just as like slick and smooth and as generous as they come, here, have a few drinks, make yourself at home, have a blast, you know, do whatever you want. And of course, he's gone and he's called the cops on his buddy. So,
and also put all the you know, evidence in his own bag so that the purse and the shoes that. And so that's when he, of course, realized that Bob is actually the killer because
dun, dun,
Babs.
Dun.
But I do actually want to discuss, too, the murder of Babs, which is just, I think, a fantastic, like, so Hitchcock. And you can just see where, you know, someone like De Palma would totally pull from that.
I feel like this could be, you could take this film and you could take the scene and just plop it right into a De Palma film.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't, you would just be like, yep, boom, De Palma.
So we've got, we've got Babs, runs into Bob Rusk and he sort of says, well, hey, you guys are running off to Paris tomorrow. Why don't you come and stay with me tonight?
Hey, and, I'm the
nicest guy. Yeah.
Hey,
I'll give you a nice room.
What do you need?
And here's some booze for you. So they end up going back to his place and it's all in one shot. We see them walking up the stairs, shot in studio. And I point that out for a very specific reason, but yeah. So they're shot in studio. They're walking up the stairs. They go into his place. And the last thing we hear is Bob Rusk say to Babs, he says, you're actually kind of my type. And like that line that he said to Brenda earlier. And then they go in, they close the door and we pull out, the camera pulls back from the door.
It's so cringy. It's
very cringy.
Yeah. Cringy.
And I think almost intentionally so too.
No, it has to be. Of course. I mean, this whole character is so just like this, you know, like the play of the super nice, generous guy character, you know, is just, it had to have been fun for the actor, but no, my, and I don't know why this is my, so yes, that I don't mean to interrupt you. We're going to finish this discussion of this amazing shot, but there's just this little detail that stands out to me, man. So, you know, she is in front of him. They're walking up the stairs. She's in front, couple steps above. They're walking up the stairs to the front door. And I love, there's this moment when they get a few stairs away from the door that he's going to unlock, where, like you said, he closes it as he says, you're my type. There's this moment where he like grabs her shoulder and like holds her back from walking up the stairs so that he can like, you know, like burst in front of her and get the door open real fast, like unlock it. It was just like this little detail. I don't know if that was direction. I don't know if that was actor's choice. I don't know if it was even just a pragmatic thing, like narrow stairway. There's not much room at the top of the stairs and he needed to be the one that opened the door, you know, just pragmatic blocking. But I don't know why that little thing stood out as such an interesting character moment though, for me. Personally,
We've pulled from down the stairs, still in the studio. We kind of exit onto the street, and then Hitchcock does a very, you know, classic rope move of him. And this is very, you know, Spielberg used this in Jaws too, where someone passes the camera, and as they pass the camera, then we switch to an actual location shot. But you don't notice the camera, you don't really, I mean, it's obvious nowadays because of course there was a different film stock being used.
It's pretty smooth though. No, but it's pretty smooth.
The move is very smooth. So the person passes the camera and then we're out on the street and this is where it's also
we're
really
hiding a cut
in relation
is what you,
to
you're,
yeah
is what,
they hide the
people
cut
out there
yeah,
to be clear you're hiding a cut
from
the
studio
the
to the
switching
location
across the, yep
but if we actually, you know, kind of contrasting with the discovery of Brenda's body, you almost expect as we pull out on the street and we see all these people passing to hear a scream or something like that, but nothing happens. It just stays completely silent. We just see the people walking by the street completely unaware that there's a murder going on above them.
Well, it's not completely silent above them. I want to add to this. It's not that it's completely silent. I think this is an important thing to mention real quickly about selling that cut, that hidden cut, is the sound design.
Oh,
because
as
we're moving backwards down the stairs and the stairs, you know, we're like having to kind of spiral around. They're not spiral stairs, but you know, it's like the back and forth.
There's like a landing at the top that kind of goes left. Yeah.
So we're kind of like sweeping around that. We're coming down as we get close to the entrance to the building, we hear all the hustle and bustle of outside, right? We start to hear people talking. We hear cars. We hear traffic, like all these things happening. And so I really feel it's that sound, of course. And then as we exit the building entrance and we're out on the street, that's what really sells that hidden cut.
Yeah. Yeah, that sound fading up and smoothly kind of transitioning from inside to outside. Yeah, no, it's definitely an incredible shot. Like that's one of the shots that just made me kind of grin.
It's a standout. It's a standout.
And then I mean the next bit too that I think is so Hitchcock, where you know Bob Rusk is trying to dispose of Babs' body and he puts her in like a potato sack and throws her in a truck.
Oh, this is
and then
just
realizes
such, this is almost like Three Stooges or something. Like
yes,
it's just,
yeah.
I feel
but I
like
think
this
it's
is...
brilliant too because it's such a Hitchcock thing to almost make you fearful that the killer, who we know is the killer, is going to be caught. Like you're almost you're with him for this extended kind of 10-minute sequence where he's in the back of a potato truck because he didn't realize that Babs has stolen his pin, like his like little pin that he wears with his initials on it.
Well, it's his tie pin. Let's make it clear. Pin, yeah. It's specifically a tie pin.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
With his initial takes it off on
before
it.
He, yeah. And so, you know, so he realized, he dumps her body. He comes back to his little flat, realizes that the pin is gone and it can only be on her body. So he goes back in, kind of climbs into the potato truck. The potato truck drives off. And then we get this great scene of him having to dig through the potatoes. The, you know, someone pulls over to tell the truck driver that his you know, the back of his truck is open and that he's got to close it. So you have all these little moments where it's like, you think, oh God, is he going to be caught? And then you kind of think to yourself, like, well, wait, why am I almost rooting for the killer in this instance? But Hitchcock does a great, he just has, you know, such great skill at putting you in the mind of the killer in this one scene and sort of understanding
the tension.
Well,
it's even the moment that he realizes, it's even the moment he realizes that the pin is gone.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, we're frankly immediately almost like in, you know, even though you're right, like we're sympathizing with him, with a killer, and we're putting ourselves in that position. And I mean, it's like literally immediately, right? Mm-hmm. He's going through all of his murder victim's clothes. He's like looking all over the house. He's like, oh, then we have this realization. It's in the potato truck. He's got to go back over there. And you're right. Hitchcock does this brilliantly. And now for the next, like you said, 10 plus minutes, it's this extended scene where he's trying to retrieve this tie pin, even with, you know, the rigor mortis that's set in to her hand. Mm-hmm. And he has to like break the fingers, you know, one by one. I mean, Hitchcock just lingers on this
And the sound of the crunch. Yeah. The cracking
of the cracking finger. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. No,
yeah,
it's so quite brilliant.
It's really,
but there
it's
humor
really great,
there too, though.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he plays it. There's definitely like a element of just like you said, this Three Stooges where he's being tossed around in the back of this truck and potatoes everywhere, and he's filthy by the time he gets
potatoes
out.
Potatoes are flying out. Stop. Yeah.
And so then of course we wrap up with the film. Our main character gets sentenced to prison for the murders, and then you know
what are your thoughts on this? Like, I'm curious. So, yeah, so he's right. So he's, you know, ultimately he's, you know, now it's two women who were known to Richard. It's like, mm-hmm. There's no way this is coincidence. He's clearly the murderer. I mean,
he was
the
found
secretary
with the things in his bag,
pointed him out. He's found with the murder victim's stuff in his bag. I mean, it's, you know, case closed kind of thing. But it's interesting. It's just like such a quick cut in time. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Hitchcock doesn't waste any time. You know, I feel like this is a thing like a lot of movies would spend some time like, oh, okay, you know, we've got our, you know, our lead is erroneously, you know, accused of this horrible crime. He's got to like sit in jail and await his trial. And now he's the trial and he's like defending himself. And oh no, I'm innocent. I swear, you know, or would it be like we'd spend at
least.
Yeah,
he even
like,
calls out, he says it's Bob Rusk. He's the real killer.
Well, but I mean, I just mean the efficiency with which this is literally like there's literally one scene, which is like one camera angle where we're outside the door of the courtroom. We mm-hmm. hear hardly any of it. And it's all we see is like the, you know, the judge is convicting him and you're right. And he at these kind of like, it's kind of yelling, you know, like it was this other guy, it was Bob. And, you know, I'm going to, well, now since I've been convicted of murder, I might as well go ahead and actually do it. I'm going to find him and kill him. But it just, it's interesting the way, like the efficiency with which this whole thing, this whole moment of time, right, in the mm-hmm. story is just kind of condensed into this one, what, maybe like 45 second shot.
Really,
it's
quick
not even,
montage almost,
we don't even have it's just extremely quick. But it was just kind of interesting to kind of compare that to different ways that different filmmakers might handle that. I just feel like, oh boy, a lot of other films would have spent time on that and would have tried to milk it, basically, right? Yeah. Would have.
Well, and there's there's this really brilliant kind of thing too with it that, you know, we really waste. You barely even see him in prison. Like he almost immediately kind of fakes his injury or gets really injured, but intentionally injures himself so he can go to the hospital. But then another thing
convicted,
that I think is just fantastic is that there's this kind of repeating dynamic between the chief inspector and his wife where he kind of keeps uncovering
we haven't talked about this. Okay.
So there's this funny little running gag with the chief inspector and
throughout
his wife
the whole
where
movie
she keeps making him these like very, you know, adventurous meals of like this fish stew that has all these like, you know, squids and
fish
things
heads
like that.
And
especially
and
back in the, you know, the 70s in Britain, this would have been like,
you know, who's
well,
you
dude
know,
who I don't know about 70s in Britain. Like right now I don't want fish head and
yeah
pig's
true
feet.
Yeah,
like
pig's
I,
feet.
I
yeah,
mean
yeah.
Look, 2024 I don't want to be eating.
Although
that.
Hey, that
no,
those Cornish hens I thought looked pretty good, or the duck or whatever it was, those little
no
little,
but the
little
whole point was that it was like no
it was so
food
tough.
It was
yeah,
like
it was,
the size
yeah
of like a yeah it was tiny no was, I, yeah, you, the, I thank you for bringing this up because like during the whole right so during this whole you know all the shenanigans they're going on here, you've got this like great interaction where the chief inspector Timothy Oxford, played by Alec McGowan, and his wife, which is played by Vivian Merchant, mm-hmm. You've got all of these kind of a series of I can't remember now, what is it, 2, 3, 4 of these scenes where he's, you know, he's at home and he's kind of, and basically what this is, he's talking to his wife, he's explaining the case to the wife. And as we go through the film, and it's basically a fun way to kind of package some exposition for us,
yes,
the yeah audience, is what Hitchcock is doing here. And to make that kind of fun, what he's done is he's put this running gag where, you know, and they're a loving couple. He's doing his best to, like, you know, be supportive of his wife and her adventures in cuisine and cooking. Mm-hmm. And but he's, you know, he's sitting down at the table and he's being served these just, you know, and I mean, and Hitchcock films this with like all of the visceral close upness that you could, you know, I mean, it's just fish heads and squids and weird sauces and pig's feet. And but there's just this running gag of him having to, like, not being able to eat at the end of a long day while he's explaining the case to his wife. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I just
and
found
his wife almost
so,
keeps
so,
like revealing these clues for him, almost like thinking of it in a completely
yep
different way. And,
yep,
and
yep,
so he
yep
keeps
yep
kind of coming on to these new
it's quite
found
fun
discoveries from
no.
And his wife, you know, Vivian Merchant is just fantastic, and her the voice that she's doing is hilarious. And but so we end up having this great, you know, kind of the final moment of that
well,
is,
and it's interesting to point out. I just want to point out too that the police are not look. They're not shown as incompetent. They're not shown as like bad guys. They're not mm-hmm trying to like. They really are trying to catch the right guy, and I mean, even going so far as this is something I feel like you know. Almost an innocence of that era, or maybe it's a cultural difference between how police are generally viewed in England versus in the United States. But I mean, it's, you know, the instant he gets that this chief gets a sense that he might have made a mistake, and he gets that sense in the courtroom, right? Hitchcock kind of actually comes back, right? We hear Richard saying, you know, well, now that I've been convicted of murder, I should go ahead and just actually do it. I'm going to get Bob. Hitchcock kind of brings us back to mm-hmm now the chief is, we focus on the chief. He's in the courtroom. So we've kind of have this little flashback kind of deal, and he's replaying that in his mind, or he's like paying attention. And we kind of see the light bulb go on in his mind of like, whoa, hey, maybe there's something, maybe we got the wrong guy. And
yeah
so he actually is really determined to get to the bottom of that, to figure it out.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so there's these great, you know, and then you have this great kind of ending where of course, Richard goes to Bob's place to kill him and, you know, take revenge after he kind of breaks out of the prison hospital and
right
gets there. And you think, again, this one kind of final red herring where he gets in and there's a dead body in there, a new victim. And right
well,
as,
but, but
as,
what we think, though, all we see is the blonde hair, which, of course,
yes,
is
yeah
our man Bob has this beautiful, very blonde head of hair. And so
yeah
that's all we see sticking out of the bed. And so Richard walks up to him with the crowbar.
The tire iron,
whack,
yeah.
Or tire iron, I mean, yeah. Whack, whack, whack. And then the arm falls, and it's clearly the arm of a woman. And he's
mm-hmm
like, and we're like, now he really has murdered someone.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. But then we
and
see,
then,
of course, the tie.
In walks
neck.
In,
yeah.
In walks in Chief Inspector Timothy Oxford.
Yeah.
Oh no. But wait. Timothy knows that he's like, and so we have this nice little double fake out at the end.
Yeah, kind of like the sting almost, where it's like you think that he's
yep
been caught, and then you hear bump, bump, bump coming up the stairs.
Yeah.
And they kind of hide. And in walks Bob with a, you know, a big kind of carrying case to
big
to put
giant
the body
trunk
in
to put the body
yeah
in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then we end
and
there,
he's
and
not
great
wearing his tie. And then
yes,
and then
not
you
wearing
get,
his tie.
You
and the chief inspector says, yeah.
Chief inspector is like, What does he say? What's the line? What's the line that ends the film?
Says something like, you're not, yeah, where's your tie? Something about the tie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, you forgot your tie or something like that. Or mm-hmm. yeah. And then it's like, then he just drops the trunk and we go to credits. And it's almost like this, just this beautiful little pat, like kind of humorous. It's like the inspector, it's not like he's in the room with a man who's a serial killer. It's just kind of like, I'll just like tell a joke and stand here and, you know, and then the killer won't try to get away and there won't be a fight, but it's like, well, I guess I've been had.
Yeah. No, it's great. It reminds me honestly of kind of the ending of the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 when you have the guy has the cold and he sneezes right at the end. And then of course the detective kind of opens his door again and looks in. It's like, I gotcha.
It's beautiful, which is beautiful.
But I think that humor is really what separates Hitchcock from so many other, you know, not only horror and thriller and suspense filmmakers, but just that, like, he just has this great way of infusing. And even though, again, the tone seems like it wouldn't fit, he really does kind of make it, you know, it works in every instance. And
yeah, this it works. At least.
I think that was, you know, one of the things that I alluded to, wanted to talk about earlier, was just this idea of, like, this is kind of the closest I think we get to seeing what Hitchcock would have been like if he continued making movies in the 70s and 80s. And I think you end up getting a lot of you know, perhaps another angle to look at that, though, is that you see the work of De Palma, of Polanski, of Spielberg, Shyamalan, and you kind of see so much Hitchcock in all of their work, too. I mean, especially, like, both Shyamalan and Polanski.
And De Palma.
And De Palma, okay, of course. Yeah. But in Polanski's movie with Harrison Ford, which is, let me get it up here because I don't want to, Frantic. Yeah, it's kind of similar name to this, actually. Frantic, where, you know, it's very similar. It's a very Hitchcockian plot about Harrison Ford and his wife in Paris, and his wife is murdered, and he's kind of framed for it. Yeah. But in that movie, there is quite literally a scene where, you know, Harrison Ford is putting on the shower. He's taking a shower, and it is shot in the exact same way as the Psycho shower scene. And then I'm thinking also in Shyamalan's, I think it's in The Happening with Mark Wahlberg, I believe, which is a great movie.
Okay, no, you finish your thought, and then we do have to talk about The Happening. Just one second, finish your thought. Sorry, I'm just so excited.
In this old woman's house, and there's this it's just shot like Hitchcock, the way that he sets up this scene in this old woman's house. And I think that it's very interesting to see these directors who so clearly, I mean, again, De Palma, the reason I didn't even mention De Palma here is because, like, every single scene from a De Palma movie can be kind of traced back to something with Hitchcock. I think De Palma is very, very open about that.
I think De Palma is what Hitchcock would have, if Hitchcock would, like, just, you know, were immortal and just kept making films, you know, through, you know, the late 80s into the early 90s. I think that's, De Palma is as close as you're going to get to what his films would have potentially looked like, I think.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
But, you know, you mentioned The Happening and I, you know, it's interesting with M. Night's films. I mean, this episode is about. And we've not done, have we done any of his films?
No.
To do that. But I feel like with The Happening, I don't know if I've ever seen a film made by a director who has so much potential and can clearly, I mean, I do feel like he is a very talented filmmaker, and when he's on, I really think especially his visual storytelling is, I mean, this, if he were like a role-playing character in a video game, like, visual storytelling would be like the highest, like, that's his highest stat,
be maxed out. Yes.
Maxed out, man. And then writing, I don't know, might be kind of, you know, it's going to be a lot lower than that. I don't know if it's one of his weakest stats, but it's like, you know, but it's just, I don't know if I can think of a movie that is so laughably horrible made by such a talented director with so much potential. Now, I've not seen the Airbender film, which I heard was like, his Airbender,
that one,
I've not
really
even seen
bad.
It. I don't know if that's worse than The Happening, but But is it really? Wow.
I can watch The Happening and have a fun time with it. The last Airbender is just awful.
But again, there are scenes in The Happening that are so good that, like, there is some visual there are scenes that are so brilliant and then juxtaposed so instantly with scenes that are so horrible. I'm just like, it is shocking. Like, I don't know if I've, I mean, you want to talk about dynamic range, but that's dynamic range in a whole different direction than what I was referring to earlier. This is like going from exceptionally well done to holy crap, I've seen student films that make this, you know, that are like Academy Award winning films compared to this, you know, this moment in this film. It's just mind blowing. Anyway, I like I said, I was feeling kind of just tangential today. So, you know, just get everything in here. But
no, but no, I think that you get this really interesting thing. I mean, I'm actually, speaking of Shyamalan as well, I'm hoping to see his new movie either tonight or tomorrow. So we'll
Trap? Or...
Yeah. And all shot up here, shot in Toronto. So and, there you go.
And, I will put this out there and I will stick with it. I will defend this. I think that Unbreakable is the best superhero comic book movie since the original Superman with not like the Donner Superman with Christopher Reeves, the first film of that, whatever, how many there were, four or five or so. I'll stick with that, that it's, and it's probably actually a better film potentially than that one, but I just have so much emotional connection to that Superman film because when I was a child. So I admit that I am clouded with nostalgia and emotion. So it's hard for me to compare them, but Unbreakable, I would put it out there, best comic book film of at least the past several decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my take.
I think that I think that it's definitely, I love Unbreakable. I mean, again, a lot of Hitchcock stuff in there too. But yeah, I mean, you look at these directors who, again, like you said, De Palma is basically, virtually what Hitchcock likely would have continued to do and be as a filmmaker. Yeah. But again, I mean, I think that like,
there's and so we've much done De Palma, right? I know we've done Carrie.
Yeah, we've done Carrie. Yeah.
Did we do any other De Palma?
The only one that we've done. I don't know if we've done another De Palma, unless we did Cape Fear, but I don't think we did Cape Fear. Scorsese. Yeah. But Scorsese doing, again, that's another very interesting thing. That was, I love Cape Fear because that seems like Scorsese doing Hitchcock. Like that movie is so Hitchcock.
I've got to revisit that. I saw that film only once and I saw it in the theater on its original release and I haven't seen it since. I do need to revisit that.
That's a lot. I love that movie. That one's fun.
So many films uses
the original Herman score, which is another thing I wanted to talk about thing I feel is, and I don't mind the score in this movie. I think it's fine. And there's not a lot of it. But I think the one thing as I sit in, you know, watch this movie and that opening shot with, you know, where it flies over London and goes down through the bridge and all that. And there's this kind of like boisterous big band kind of score playing. And I just sit there and go, man, what would Herman have done for this? And it's like, I think of Herman and Hitchcock as kind of the, you know, original, like Spielberg and Williams.
It's like chocolate and peanut butter.
It's like you get this.
You're right. It's like Spielberg and Williams.
Such perfect kind of synergy. And it's a very unfortunate, you know, kind of sad story that they had a falling out and then they never spoke again.
The intention is not to put you on the spot, but do we know exact, or, you know, maybe not just we, but does the world know, like, what was their falling out? Was it just personal?
Yeah, basically. So it was that they were doing, I can't remember which film it was. It might have been Marnie or Torn Curtain. It was one of the later ones. But they were doing a movie.
Right before this film.
Yeah, and Hitchcock Hitchcock basically was unhappy with Herman's score and replaced it. And they sort of got into a fight and kind of parted ways and literally never spoke until Hitchcock's death. And apparently Herman was very upset about that when he died because he was hoping that at some point they would have, you know, reunited and kind of worked together again, but they never did. But there's a lot of interesting stuff with that too. So again, that's the one thing I feel like is missing from this movie is like a fantastic Bernard Herrmann's
like
score.
A really
not that it has to be used
score.
A lot, but I think that the other thing is that Herrmann clearly knew when to, like, when it was appropriate to not use music, you know, like he was great at kind of holding back on in certain moments. So I don't think that it would have been a you know, something where it's like, oh, there's just music throughout. I think that I would have been so curious to see, but there's kind of layers to that too, because Henry Mancini was supposed to score the movie, wrote a, you know, full soundtrack for it.
I think
it,
a full then, soundtrack, a full score. Yeah.
Because I think it's, like you said, I think it was available.
I think you can purchase it now on re-releases of the soundtrack. They've included his soundtrack. Yes.
And so, and Hitchcock apparently said that his reason for replacing Mancini and firing Mancini was because he said that if I wanted Herman, I would have, you know, I would have gotten Herman. And so there's this kind of like, you know, backhand.
Do you think that was stylistic or do you think that was stylistic? Like Hitchcock is saying, look, you know, because this happened.
I think
he's, right?
I think
you
his know, kind of accusation was that he personal? Was, like, was, he, was trying he, to. Yeah.
Did,
yeah, who knows?
Did something personal happen between those two men where, and so his like rejection of a similar sounding soundtrack was more kind of personal. Like I'm pissed at Herman and I don't want anything that even sounds
yeah,
like
I don't
him
because
it reminds
music.
Me,
yeah,
of,
yeah.
It reminds me of him. Or was it like, you know, cause look, you get to a point, right? I mean, how many, you know, especially let's take Williams or, you know, Herman, I mean, both have sounds that are so similar that it's like their stamp is going to be on your film no matter what, mm-hmm. no matter what they try to do. I
yes,
just
they're as much
like,
of a part of the film as like the director in a lot of ways. Yeah.
And I totally respect that a director might be like, hey, I want to try something different. You know, this is mm-hmm. a different type of film, or I want to try to go a different direction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I continue to use you, I know that it's going to be in this certain space of a soundtrack. And I don't, you know, I really want to go somewhere different. Mm-hmm. I can certainly see how that could be potentially, you know, obviously that could get personal, right? If you've worked with somebody for a long time and one of them says, hey, I don't want to use you. Yeah. You know, I can certainly see how that might hurt, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think, yeah. So then in the end, Ron Goodwin.
So if you ever come to me and say, I want a new co-host for podcast, I will be very
well,
hurt, dude.
The way that I would do it if it was Hitchcock was that because Hitchcock actually fired Herman in front of the orchestra. Like he like went in, listened to a recording and said and fired him literally. And it was apparently so humiliating for Herman.
So you're going to fire
naturally.
Me while we're recording
so
an episode?
While we're recording, I'll fire you. I don't know if I have the authority.
Not
to
if
that,
I fire but, you first. What if
exactly,
I...
exactly. Then there'll be nothing. We'll fire each other.
We'll fire each other,
so,
yes.
Yeah, Ron.
We'll hire two new people. No, you know, we'll,
oh, yes.
we'll just get,
yes,
we'll get
idea.
Two AIs. We're going to, yeah. like, what we'll do is we'll kind of, like, we'll get two different AIs, and we'll both kind of just each program some parameters in each of the two separate AIs, and we'll just, like, let yes. the AIs have a conversation for an hour, and then just record it and put it out there.
And it would be perfect for all the TikTok kids. I mean, they'd love that. That would be exactly
oh,
what we should do with them. I mean, we probably could
you know
make
that's
so much
gonna
money
happen.
Doing that.
You know that that is totally going to happen, right? Because
yeah.
they have AIs
it
writing
probably already
articles.
Has happened.
I'm sure. And there's probably a, you know, and obviously it's easy to have like a language AI have just mm-hmm. give it a voice, you know, a synthesized yeah. voice. And then
you can give it your own
boom.
Voice. You can let it learn your
there
own
you
voice.
There you go. You're
but,
right. Or we could even,
yeah.
we could even,
I mean,
do,
who
we
knows?
Could even
we could
have,
do it right now. We could be, we could
could
be AI
it.
Right now.
We might be AI right now, but we could do it, right? Like we could take like, so for instance, like this movie, we could have one of the people be like, take Alfred Hitchcock's voice, right? Train the AI on Hitchcock's voice. And mm-hmm. then, like, the other person we could train on De Palma's voice, and then we could have both of them discuss, like, we could have Hitchcock be mad at De Palma for, like, aping his style.
Yes.
We could have De Palma,
yeah.
like, criticizing Hitchcock, like, that, you know, De Palma, he's like, I did it and did it even better, and we could just see what that would look like for an hour.
Well, it would be, I mean, it would be probably very similar to the real story of Hitchcock and Spielberg, where Spielberg
yeah.
wanted to meet Hitchcock. It was right after Spielberg did Jaws. Which obviously has takes a lot of, you know, influence from Hitchcock, and wanted
right.
to meet Hitchcock, and Hitchcock said, "The boy that directed the Fish movie, I don't think so." And
I mean, but let's be honest though, Hitchcock is the boy that directed the Bird movie.
Yes,
so
exactly. That's
I
the
mean,
irony, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, here's what I'm waiting for to happen. It hasn't happened yet, as far as I know, right? Because we had all these Sharknado movies, and I mean, there's ton, right, The Meg, or I mean, there's like a ton of kind of this continuation of Jaws type. Films
yeah.
right with
yeah.
large fish that are eating
Megalodon
people and stuff.
Yeah yeah
right all that so but where is like Birds versus Shark I've
oh,
not
don't
seen
say,
that
don't put that into the universe because I'm sure there's
oh,
probably
it's out
someone
there.
Working on it right
oh.
now
oh maybe that person's me because I mean we've had like Predator versus Alien like mm-hmm. Birds versus Shark is I think that's the next hot thing matter of fact I may need to edit this out because I don't want somebody to steal this idea. It's that good.
Or some AI is going to scrub through the episode and listen to it and start generating that too.
It's already being written. As soon yeah. as we publish this, an AI is going to grab it. It's going to write a script. It's going to land on some script reader's desk, but the script reader is going to use an AI to scan the scripts instead of reading it. It's just, yeah, I can see it
yeah.
now.
No, exactly.
Yep,
exactly.
Just, this will be on Netflix in 2026.
Yeah, yeah. But to go to bring it all full circle. To return to Hitchcock's
to frenzy. Return to Earth. To return.
So
to Earth.
Yeah, they ended up he got Ron Goodwin to score it, which again I think is kind of a it's a bit of a lackluster score. There's a few moments that I actually really like. The one right after
it didn't
the,
stand out to my
murder,
ears.
The first murder. There's like a really great kind of creepy sounding little cue there, and I like that. So it's not all. It's just a little bit underwhelming, I think.
Creepy sounding little cue. If you go to the soundtrack, that's actually what the piece is titled. Just
look up that piece exactly. Yeah, but I think it's a. You know, I think it's a. I like this movie a lot. I think it's all in all a very fun, but also disturbing and
it's got a great great beat and it's easy to dance to. I'm appreciative of you picking it. Like I said, it's funny. I know that I'd seen the film. I had not seen it in a very long time. And it's funny that the only scenes that I really had a strong recollection of were those scenes that we discussed where the chief inspector is eating dinner or having, being served dinner by his wife. Yeah. And she keeps serving him all of these just outrageous meals. And his struggle to maintain his composure in the while he's starving, I felt like it was like a Fawlty Towers, like I really got like a vibe of that, and I'm sure it's just because of the extreme Britishness of both of those things, but I just got like a total like John Cleese Fawlty Towers vibe going on from those scenes. Albeit a little more reserved and in toned down from what you would have seen in Fawlty Towers. Anywho. On that note, thanks for picking the film, man. It was a real treat, and it was a fun time talking with you about it. So that means now that it's my turn to pick a film. And so I guess I better get on that.
We'll see what you pick. Everybody, maybe it'll be Trapped, Shyamalan.
Yeah. Maybe it's going to be The Happening is actually.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. We've only done one film that both of us kind of... weren't super thrilled with, and that was the Attack of the Clones. I feel like Attack of the Clones is Citizen Kane compared to The Happening. So, but anyway, we'll keep everyone in suspense. And speaking of, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate everyone out there. If you have any suggestions for films that you'd like to see us do, well, just look us up, shoot us a line, and. Mm-hmm. What is our email address for people?
Well, it's all our socials are in the descriptions of the thing.
Yeah,
so,
all our stuff. Yeah, you go anywhere. Yeah. You can Facebook, Instagram, Twitter,
comment on YouTube
X or something.
Yeah.
Now, YouTube, you can comment on YouTube. Yep, we check out all those spots and all those avenues are ways you can get a hold of us. All right, until next time, we'll catch you on the flip side.
Mm-hmm. Bye bye.